we're so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
You know, the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to Animal Voices, Western Canada's only radio program dedicated to animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is 100.5 FM, Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, unceded Coast Salish territories. Today is Friday, August 24th, 2018. I'm your host, Elise Jacobson, and I'm joined here in the studio today by my guest control room operator, Jody Pongratz.
Hello.
So when you hear the word vegan used to describe someone or the phrase animal rights activist, what are some of the first things you think of? There are all sorts of stereotypes around what vegans look like and who we are. I think the most common ones tend to be the green juice guzzling hippie or the, you know, kind of pale skinny hipster.
Scary, like
red paint
throwing. People are so afraid of vegan activists. Let me say
that's so true. Yeah, that's so true. And these stereotypes obviously are most often white and able-bodied as well. Well, you know what? Get comfy, because we're going to be doing some myth-busting for you today. The truth is that vegans and animal advocates come in all shapes, sizes, and colors from all over the world and all walks of life. So today's show is dedicated to giving you a little taste of the wonderful diversity in the global vegan community. And we'll begin that in just a few minutes, so stay tuned. But first, we have some news for you. This is a local news story from the CBC. Photos showing a man holding what appears to be an electric prod at the Chilliwack Fair Rodeo are raising concerns from the Vancouver Humane Society. The photos were taken last weekend by a photographer working for the Humane Society, which often documents activity at rodeos around British Columbia. While the Society expects to see animals in distress at rodeos, spokesperson Peter Fricker said no one was expecting to see an electric prod being used. Quote, "That was a complete surprise to us," Fricker said. "We haven't seen them used in a Canadian rodeo before. We've heard about their use. We've seen evidence of them in American rodeos, but this is the first time we've come across them in a rodeo in BC," unquote. The photos were taken during the bull riding event moments before the bulls were released from the chute. Normally, Fricker said the bulls are held in the chute, mounted by a rider, and then just before the bull is released, a leather strap, called a flank strap, is tightened around the bull's hindquarters. And the rider also usually wears boots with spurs. He said, quote, "In our view, the bull is being treated in a very cruel way. It has an unwanted rider on its back. It's being spurred, and this flank strap is also causing it distress." So to have that already happen and then to receive an electric shock in addition to all these things just seems completely wrong to us, unquote. No one from the Chilliwack Fair or BC Rodeo Association responded to requests for comment. That's a little bit disturbing. I mean, I think it's common knowledge that rodeos are spectacles of animal cruelty anyway. There's a lot of events that are dangerous and very distressing for the animals, but for them to be using electric prods at the Chilliwack Rodeo is kind of a whole new level. So there are things that you can do to resist this. Most of the time when there are rodeos, there are protests that are organized, so keep an eye out for those. And obviously you can write to your member of parliament, you can write to the, you know, Chilliwack Fair Association and tell them what you think about this. So, moving on, first up, we are going to play for you a talk given by disability rights activist and animal rights activist Mary Fantaski at the Human Rights or Animal Rights Conference in Guelph, Ontario in 2013. The talk is entitled "The Disabled Body and the Animal Body." So here's that for you.
Hello, everybody. I will be exploring the concepts of ableism and speciesism and the intersectionality between the two, which I argue is absolutely critical to the point where you can't tease the two apart. I want to begin with a quote that I actually shared on the event page, a few days ago, but it really sums up everything that I'm trying to say, so I'm going to repeat it for you again. And this quote is from Mia Mingus, a disability rights activist. And she states, "Ableism is connected to all our struggles because it undergirds notions of whose bodies are considered valuable, desirable, and disposable." So to begin, I just want to get a couple of definitions out of the way. The first is disability. It might seem at first to be quite straightforward, but it actually is a complicated categorization. Disability, as I am attempting to define it, is whether a person can function in a way that is expected or not. This expectation usually comes from society, as opposed to what most people think, the medical world. So I argue that disability is not necessarily just about the body, it is about society and how they view that body. On the other hand, though, disability has been claimed as a self-identity for many people with chronic illnesses or other challenges. I myself have claimed the term, and I refer to myself as disabled. And it is not a dirty word if you can say it. And it is also important to acknowledge that disabilities can be either visible or invisible. There is quite a problematic idea that the people with disabilities in our society always use a wheelchair. And if they use a wheelchair, they are always paralyzed. This is not remotely true. Many people with disabilities appear able-bodied on first glance. I myself am one of them, although I now, as my disabilities are becoming a bit more of a challenge, usually have a brace, like the one on my wrist, or a cane. Sometimes I do use a wheelchair. But on good days, when my pain is low, I will look like the average young white girl. And people will question, you know, why I take the elevator to go up one floor. So it's important to recognize that, you know, just because somebody is using a wheelchair does not mean that they are not disabled. And now I want to define ableism for you, and I have two quotes to accomplish this. The first quote is from Rachel Cohen Rottenberg, from this year, also a disability rights activist that I encountered online. And she states, "Ableism is a form of bigotry that values non-disabled people over disabled people. It is also a part of a system that segregates, excludes, and denies disabled people our basic rights to social, economic, political, and architectural access. It becomes internalized with the result that disabled people learn to feel ashamed of our bodies and minds as wrong, tragic, broken, pitiful, disgusting, and freakish." The second quote I have for you is as follows. "Ableism reflects the sentiment of certain groups and social structures that value and promote certain abilities over others." And the last bit there is absolutely crucial to what I will be discussing, the idea that certain abilities are valued over others. A few examples of the consequences of ableism. They range from accessibility issues, which I have been dealing with all day today. So not having ramps, not having power-operated doors, not having elevators, that sort of thing. That is architectural discrimination. To sterilization, many disabled people with uteruses find themselves being, especially if they have severe cognitive disabilities, find themselves being sterilized against their consent because there is this notion that disabled people should not reproduce. And our final example of ableism is an assumption of a poor quality of life. So unfortunately, I have had multiple people tell me, without my asking, that if they had my illnesses, they would just kill themselves. And this, unfortunately, is something that I have found in my discussions with other disabled people that every disabled person seems to hear. And this is because there is this idea that health is everything. And you can see it in, you know, statements that I have used, which is, you know, thank God you have your health. At least you have your health. And so there's this idea that if you're disabled, your quality of life must automatically be poor. And that is ableism in a show. Now, I want to, just one last definition for you guys, sorry. I want to define the concept of humanism. The definition of humanism that I've tried to put together is that equal moral respect is owed to all and only human beings. This means that a wrong is only a wrong when it is committed against a human person. Now, at first glance, and, you know, just try and not think of animal rights for a couple of seconds, I know it's difficult. In terms of human rights, this seems like an okay definition. Every human deserves the same rights. But the problem becomes, how do we define a human person? Who is a human person? Is a person with disabilities who uses a fake limb or uses a power-operated wheelchair as much as a human being or more of a human being than someone that does not? Is a young child the same degree of a person as an adult? And so we see that the definition of a human person, far from being a natural category, is actually totally socially constructed. And it is constructed in such a way that it is both speciesist and ableist. The current definition of a human being, as I have come to see it, in asking people, how do you define a human person? And I will often say, compared to an animal. And almost the first thing that everyone says is, well, humans are rational. They're rational, logical beings that can think scientifically and without emotion or instinct. This idea was discussed by ecofeminist Plumwood in the 1990s, and she noted that rationality is valued in our society, Western society, over emotionality and physicality. And this preference for certain abilities over others leads to a labeling or of real or perceived deviations from a lack of an essential trait as a diminished state of being. And that is a quote from Woolbring, an intersectional disability rights activist who also looks at speciesism. In other words, the idea that a human being is rational, that a human person is rational without instinct, leads to a discrimination against those that are considered to not be rational. And this is key. It does not matter whether you are a rational person or not. What matters is how you are perceived. So women are perceived as being less rational than men. And since the definition of the human being is rational, scientific, without emotion, not limited by their body, women become seen as less than human, less than a person. And the same is true for persons with disabilities. Since we are considered to not be rational, especially if one has a mental illness or a cognitive disability, and we are seen as having our body or physicality rule our behavior. And here Woolbring brings in speciesism, and I want to use a quote from him again, which states that speciesism assigns different values and rights based on the abilities of the animals. Humans are seen as superior over other species because of their exhibition of superior cognitive abilities. And so here we can see where speciesism and ableism come together in such a way that they are inextricably intertwined. Since both systems of oppression are founded on this idea of the importance of certain capabilities, the critical importance of these capabilities, to the point where you are not a true person if you are not considered to have these capabilities. And I would argue that speciesism and ableism are so intertwined that they almost appear to be the same form of oppression, as they both are founded on the idea of you do not have rationality, therefore you're not as much of a person as the white, rational, straight male over here. When I say that sentence, you could put in either a non-human person or a human person with disabilities in regards to who that would be in reference to. It's not clear whether I was saying you, the human, are not rational, or you, the animal. And so we see how ableism and speciesism are almost completely ingrained in the definition of the human being. For how do we define the human being, then, if it's not by rationality, if it's not by binaries and what makes us different, then who is the human person? And suddenly we find ourselves at a loss to define this concept, which seems so natural to us in this society. As such, those who are considered to not have these capabilities or these traits are othered, meaning they are marginalized and pushed to the boundaries. This othering makes their loss of rights reasonable, since they are not as much of a person as those that hold these characteristics. Therefore, it is because the definition of the human person has been defined in regards to what it is not. It is not emotional, it is not physical, it is not instinctual, that persons with disabilities and non-human persons find themselves oppressed by society. In conclusion, persons with disabilities and non-human persons, as well as other marginalized people, such as people of color, queer individuals, etc., they are not considered to possess the prized trait of rationality. And therefore, they do not meet the qualifications of the true human person and lose their personhood. And here I want to emphasize that this is not something that we think through. I don't look at cute little dog right there and go, he's not a human, therefore he or she is not a person. This is not a thought process. It is ingrained unconsciously into our being as a result of how we have been socialized. The loss of personhood, or the diminishing of personhood as a result of the perceived inability to think rationally or to think beyond the body, results in the objectification of these persons. We see this when animals are turned into food. They are literally turned into objects because their personhood is considered to not exist. I see this in my day-to-day life, especially when I am using a wheelchair, where people stare at me, even if I stare back, and I get the feeling that I'm in a zoo. And I'm there to be gazed at, to be gawked at, because I am interesting and different, and ooh, look at that strange thing. And thus my personhood in that situation has been lost. This results in discrimination and violence against non-human persons, disabled persons, and other marginalized persons. And a quote, just to sum up what I've really been trying to get at here, and again from Wolbring, because he is fabulous and really understands the intersectionality between ableism and speciesism. He states that judgment based on abilities is so ingrained in society that its use for exclusionary purposes is hardly ever questioned or realized. And so today I challenge all of you to prove him wrong. I challenge all of you, myself included, to question the importance of certain abilities, to question the importance of being able to walk on two legs or to think rationally, and to critically reflect on what it means to be a true person. Thank you.
That was disability rights activist and animal rights activist Mary Fantasky speaking at the Human Rights Are Animal Rights Conference in Guelph. Next up, we have an interview with vegan activist Adi Namaran Kolabali from Accra, Ghana, hosted by Black Vegans Rock. Adi is an environmental activist and editor of Health Africa Vegan Magazine, and here she speaks to Black Vegans Rock about what it's like to be vegan in Ghana and why she promotes a plant-based lifestyle.
Could be another reason for that, but...
Hi.
Hi.
What's your name?
My name is Adi Namaran Kolabali.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too.
So we're here in Ghana, Accra.
Yeah, I'm in Accra.
What's it like being vegan in Accra?
Being vegan in Accra is actually exciting because you get to meet people who are surprised to see that you're vegan, and they ask a lot of interesting questions. And even though some see it as a religion, we try to explain to them that it's not a religion, it's a way of life. So it's quite interesting being a vegan in Ghana. Yeah.
Do you do a lot of vegan outreach in Ghana?
Yes. What we're doing right now is Meatless Monday campaign, where we're trying to let people understand that going meatless at least once a week, it helps the environment and it also helps their health and other things. So it's a gradual process. We want them to start with at least one day in the week and then they go on to being vegan.
So what was people's response been when you tried to encourage them?
It's very positive because they've got to know the importance of the vegan diet, especially with the health issues, because lots of people have diabetes and other illnesses that can be avoided. So they get to know that eating a vegan diet helps their health, and I think that's one point that we use to actually reach out to them. Yeah.
So you also write a magazine?
Yes, we have a vegetarian magazine. Actually, it's the first, I think it's the first in Africa. We have the second edition. It's called Health Africa Magazine, and I'm the editor of the magazine. So far we've had positive responses. It's actually going on well. And we have recipes in there, we have health issues, we have vegan issues about veganism and all that. So people get to know how to be vegan gradually. They get to know about the importance of organic foods as well.
What made you want to set up the vegan magazine?
We actually realized that people don't really know what vegetarianism is really about. So we, as a way of letting people know more about vegetarianism, as a way of creating awareness actually about what veganism is really about, so that they get to know that it's not about just eating salads or something, but it's a way of life, you know. It's about avoiding drinks, carbonated drinks. It's about avoiding stuff like too much salt, too much oil. It's about eating healthy, you know. Yeah.
Because you think a lot of Africans need to focus on their health?
Yes, because at first Africans were not really getting sick that much, but now we're eating just like, let me say the Americans, we're eating junk food, we're eating frozen foods that have been in the fridge for, you know, so long a time, and we don't really know the source of the food and how long it's been in the fridge. We're eating all kinds of things that are unhealthy, and people are reusing the oil, you know, over and over again. And I mean, many things that are not healthy. And now Africans have cancer and all that. We didn't have it at first, but now we're having cancer and all other lots of illnesses. So, so we're trying to create healthier lifestyles with veganism in Accra.
So do you think when they improve their health, they then increase their compassion for animals as well?
Lots of people don't really care, I would say, about animals. They see, like, you know, animals are meant to be eaten. So that's why we're using the health aspect of it, yeah.
So what about you? Did you, like, become aware of animals?
Mine wasn't about compassion for animals. It was actually more about the environment. Yeah, first of all, it was the environment. And secondly, it was also spiritual reasons. And also, I got to know about what animals are going through. You know, the antibiotics and all that, and the way they are crowded, the way they are treated. You know, it's very inhumane. And yeah, so all that kind of led me to be a vegan.
So what type of spiritual reasons did you have for going vegan?
I read about, you know, there's a lady called Supreme Master Ching Hai. She talks a lot about veganism and the environment and the spiritual aspects of it. So basically, it kind of elevates you spiritually. Yeah, it makes you higher than, I don't know how to explain it, but it elevates your spirit when you're vegan.
Are there many people that speak about Supreme Master?
Yeah, she's known worldwide. Yeah. Because when the Bible says, let me use the Bible for instance, when it says thou shalt not kill, you know, people don't really know what it means. It means thou shalt not kill. It didn't say human beings or animals, but it means don't kill at all. Don't kill anything. So killing animals is not right anyway. Yeah. So.
That's good. So what do you think is a good way to promote veganism?
Yeah, I think, we can use the various reasons why we have to be vegan. We have the environmental reasons, and I think at this point in time, it's very, very urgent that we really try to be vegan to curb climate change. You know, it's an issue that was discussed at COP21, and lots of people talking about it, and sometimes you take it for granted, but it's a serious issue. So I think for me, the environment comes first, you know, and being vegan, because you're saving the world.
So what do people think when you
told
them you're going vegan?
Yeah, lots of negative reactions. They'll be like, oh, so now you're joining the Rastafarians and all that. I'm like, no, it's a way of life. Sometimes they don't really understand it. They think you're being a fanatic or you're going extreme. But at the end of the day, it's a personal conviction. So gradually. My family, for instance, my mother is getting to understand the importance of veganism, and she's open to it, so I'm sure very soon she's going to be vegan.
Have the school started to promote the Vegan Mondays?
Yeah, that's what we're trying to do right now. We're trying to make them at least make the kids go meatless on Mondays, because I mean, we have this misconception about balanced diets, where they think that children have to be on milk, have to be on eggs and all that. And we're trying to tell them that no, that's not really a balanced diet. A balanced diet, I mean, needs to have everything, protein, vegetables. It can have all those things without meat and meat. So it's something we're trying to do with the schools, and it's picking up.
So what's your favorite vegan meal?
My favorite vegan meal is granite soup with mushrooms and brown rice. Yeah, that's my favorite.
What other type of Ghanaian food can you make vegan?
Yeah, we have banku. I can do banku and okra stew, palm nut soup. We have beans and plantain. We have bambara beans as well. We have wache, which is beans and rice together. We have eba, which is Nigerian, but I like it as well.
Do you have any advice for people that want to go vegan?
Yeah, I would say you should find a reason. I mean, find a personal reason why you want to be vegan. Nobody can force you into it. It has to be a personal conviction, because if somebody tells you to be vegan, you're going to have doubts, and then later on you might go back to your former ways. So I would say it's a gradual process. So if you want to start being vegan, just start gradually. For instance, you can start with Meatless Monday. Every Monday you can just go vegan on Mondays, and then it's going to pick up gradually. Yeah. Thank you too.
Thanks a lot.
So that was vegan activist and journalist Adi Namaran Koulibaly from Accra, Ghana. And we have some events to share with you now. Saturday, August 25th, 9 to 11 a.m. at Hastings and Commercial, Vancouver Chicken Save is having their weekly chicken vigil at Hallmark Slaughterhouse. Their event page says, "We come together to bear witness and say goodbye to the chickens before they go to slaughter." Taking it to the next level, we are also there to document any cruelty and extreme suffering or even dead chickens in the crates. With documenting, we need people shooting close up as well as far away, meaning footage of the actual event of bearing witness, the scene as a whole. We also have a presence out front on the northeast corner of Hastings and Commercial. People are invited to hold signs, wave to drivers, and open people's eyes to the fact that this gray, nondescript building is in fact a slaughterhouse. Please join us in spreading the message of compassion and kindness. So again, that's tomorrow morning, August 25th, 9 to 11 a.m. at Hastings and Commercial. Then on Tuesday, August 28th, 6:30 a.m. to 8:30 a.m. at the northwest corner of Hastings and Salisbury, there will be another chicken vigil, this time in the early morning. Come bear witness for the victims of our local slaughter industry. That's Tuesday, August 28th, 6:30 a.m. at Hastings and Salisbury. And then on Saturday, September 1st, from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. at West 16th and McDonald's, it's a giant garage sale for the animals hosted by Stop UBC Animal Research. 100% of the proceeds will go to getting animals out of research labs. They are looking for volunteers to help out with the garage sale. Send an email to adavsociety@gmail.com if you can help with setup or takedown. So again, that's a big garage sale for the animals Saturday, September 1st at 11 a.m. at West 16th and McDonald's. And moving on, next we're going to play for you an interview with Sean O'Callaghan, also known as Fat Gay Vegan, speaking with journalist and DJ Phil Marriott.
So my guest today is one of the most talked about vegan bloggers. I'm so pleased that you're here, Sean O'Callaghan, otherwise known as Fat Gay Vegan. Thank you very much for coming down.
Thank you for having me here.
Now, I am a recent vegan. I've been a vegetarian since I was probably about 8 or 9. Mm-hmm. Went vegan when I was about 19, 20. Found it really difficult at the time, but now I've gone back to it. So I'm a new vegan, have been for about 3 months now, and I found your blogs really educational and
thank
helpful.
You.
So I just want to say thank you for kind of giving me the light, giving me a bit of a path.
Okay.
It's a lot easier.
Okay, well, thank you for going vegan and making that choice for the animals. I think it's wonderful.
So, how did you start? I've read a lot about you, but for the people that are watching that don't know much about you and haven't read your blogs,
okay,
where did it all begin?
So, where did I start as a vegan blogger? Or
yeah.
Would you like me to go back to my childhood in a caravan park by the ocean, Summer Bay in Australia?
Yeah, it's like the psychiatrist's couch, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, that's right.
You gotta
well, if I go way back in time... I did grow up in Australia, and that's where I turned vegetarian. And I thought I was the height of compassion, being vegetarian, as many of us do. But it wasn't until I moved to the UK and I started to have internet access. Not that we didn't have it in Australia.
Right.
I don't mean that at all. I don't know. I haven't been there in a while. They still might not have it. I'm not
air
sure.
Punching for the UK.
We've got internet. No, it was around the time we had AOL dial-up and, Billy Piper was on the box all the time. Around that, to give you a sort of a framework of the time period, the Honeys. I'll just run through a few of my favorite pop bands.
That's
from
great.
The time. But I thought I knew everything about animal compassion and welfare, and then I started to access information on the internet, and I started to hear the word vegan, which I didn't really understand before that. And then I started to go find out there were some vegan festivals in London, and it was amazing. It was like someone had lifted the veil off my head, and I suddenly understood that I wasn't being as compassionate as I could be. And it all started from there for my vegan journey.
Right. It was your sister, wasn't it, that helped you as well?
Yeah, well, my sister and I would fight a lot. She was living with me in London, and she when I found out that some wine and beer was filtered using animal products,
yeah.
And when I was still eating cheese, she would take no small delight in ribbing me and telling me that I was a hypocrite, and we would argue until one day it's like a light went on in my head, and I was like, do you know what, I really am a hypocrite for doing this. If I want to do the best I can do for animals, well, step one is to not eat the byproducts.
Yeah.
And It was amazing. It was overnight. I just was like, okay, I'm not vegetarian anymore. To me, that means nothing. I'm vegan, and I'm going to be vegan for the rest of my life.
That's kind of how I became a vegan again, because the first time I did it, I really wasn't aware of the horrors of the dairy industry in particular. And I just, this time around, I just thought it was just a natural progression. I just, and I feel it's a lot easier this time around as well. Obviously, because a lot of shops are selling more vegan products, processed products, to make it easier to eat, you know, when you're in a hurry. But my partner, I know that your partner's vegan as well, is that right?
Yes, that's right.
I'm not trying to convince him to be a vegan, because I think everyone's got their own choice, but he does eat a lot of vegetarian food with me when I cook, and when he cooks he does it, but he's struggling with certain certain vegan products. Well, he hates vegan cheese.
Give him 3 months and then break up with him.
That's quite severe.
just kidding. I hope your partner doesn't blame me if something does go wrong, but I find that an interesting point, actually. Josh and I have been in a relationship for, I think, about 18 years now, and we both went vegan at the same time, and we were both vegetarian when we met. I can't imagine what it would be like dating non-vegans now. I mean, I wouldn't want to walk into the kitchen and see my partner with their fist inside a turkey or something.
So that was Sean O'Callaghan, also known as Fat Gay Vegan, speaking with journalist and DJ Phil Marriott. You can check out Sean's website and blog at fatgayvegan.com. And last but not least, we present Abhay Rangan, a 21-year-old entrepreneur and animal rights activist from Bangalore, India. Abhay is the founder and CEO of a startup called Vegan Arc, which aims to make dairy-free milk and other plant-based food products that are affordable and accessible to everyone. He gave this talk at the TEDx Youth at Brookfield Conference last year.
Let's begin with a thought experiment. There's a railway track, and it splits into two. Let's call the one in the front track one, and the one behind track two. On track one, there are five people tied. On track two, there's one person. You are standing near the railway track with a switch next to you. If you do nothing, the train will come on track one and kill five people. If you pull the switch, the train will divert to track two and kill one person instead. What would you do? This thought experiment is called the trolley problem. And surprisingly, a lot of people are divided on what the most ethical answer is. Let's consider another scenario. Same setting, different situation. On track one, there are animals: cows, hens, buffaloes, pigs, turkeys, goats, and so on. On track two, there is absolutely nothing. If you pull the switch, the train will go on to track two, and absolutely no negative consequence is there based on your actions. What would you choose to do? Would you choose to pull the switch? If you thought yes, congratulations, you understand veganism. All of us understand that animals are individuals who are capable of feeling pain, happiness, joy, sorrow, suffering, curiosity, and love. They care for their family, they care for their young ones, they care for their friends. And yet, we assign numbers to them, not names, numbers, like they are factory units on a production line. Society considers animals as objects, but we know they are more. They are not objects, they are individuals. I understood that animals are individuals who deserve to live just as much as we do. And in their capacity to suffer and in their desire to live, we are all equal. When I understood that, I also understood what happens in the production of animal products. Take India's dairy industry, for example. Male calves are killed because male mammals don't lactate. When a cow stops lactating, she's slaughtered. She's pumped with hormones and artificially inseminated to make sure that she continues giving milk. animal products require and necessitate a lot of cruelty. And if it stands to reason that we shouldn't be consuming them because it causes them harm and because we can consume other alternatives instead. Plant-based food is the future. A lot of people ask me, Abhay, now that you're vegan, what do you eat? The answer is most certainly not grass. Plant-based alternatives are the future for many reasons. Resource constraints. Plant-based food requires fewer resources to manufacture, and it almost requires zero animal cruelty. I wouldn't say zero because zero cruelty is an impossible ideal to attain. However, we can minimize the cruelty we're causing. You can replicate the taste of meat, milk, cheese, honey, eggs, any animal product by using plant-based ingredients. And this is exactly what we decided to pursue. When I decided to start looking out for plant-based alternatives, because I decided to be vegan, I decided to stop participating in and financing the cruelty of animals by buying animal products, and I started looking for plant-based alternatives. To my surprise and disappointment, I found that alternatives were several times costlier than their animal product counterparts. This disappointed me, because if we wanted more people to eat plant-based food, then it made sense for it to be in the reach of everybody. And I, on a student budget, was not able to afford so many of them. So we decided to start Veganarchy, a company that manufactures nutrient-rich, tasty and eco-friendly plant-based products that can replace animal products. We considered three things before we jumped in. One, the challenge. Two, our solutions. And three, the opportunities. The challenge. The dairy industry in India is a gigantic monster. That number you see right there, that is the kgs of milk India produced in 2011 and 12. That's 1279 followed by 8 zeros in terms of kgs of milk produced. It's a huge industry with deep pockets, enormous power, and it abuses countless animals. Thanks to enormous propaganda machines that have been set up, we consume more and more milk every day, and the dairy industry only keeps on growing, unchallenged by anyone. Our solution is to not just manufacture nutritionally equivalent products, but to manufacture nutritionally superior products by using fortification. This is the curd we make. So it tastes almost similar to the curd made from cow's milk. And it didn't involve the suffering of anyone, and it consumes fewer natural resources. So our idea is to not just make nutritionally superior products, but to also keep the prices in check such that everyone will be able to afford these products. Now here comes the opportunities. What can you do with products like these? For one, you can manufacture them in a plant or a cooperative society of farmers. Usually farmers and other people who are dependent on using animals and abusing animals for a livelihood don't have to do it anymore. They can manufacture plant-based alternatives. And by setting up and financially empowering these hubs, we get to create entrepreneurial hubs in every single corner of the country. When you make nutrient-rich products, you stand a decent chance at combating malnutrition. Introduce these products into government food programs and you ensure that quality nutrition reaches every single child in the country, all at a lesser cost to us and to the environment because we consume fewer natural resources and at minimal harm to animals. This is what we decided to pursue. The future looks pretty exciting for plant-based food and food in India in general. When we were kids, we were asked, hey, what do you think about the future? And all of us had bright, optimistic versions of it. We said, they're going to be big cities, really cool cars, really cool planes, we're going to time travel. And we had amazing ideas. Now, as we are older, when we are asked what we think the future is going to look like, we say it's going to be horrible. That's because we know that in the next 50 years, the population of humans on planet Earth will be about 10 billion people. It is going to be a huge task to manage these resources. And we are currently living like we have two planet Earths, We just got one. Morality, justice, ethics, liberty, freedom, equality, all these are not just fancy marketing terms towards the animal rights movement. They form the very core of it. And we as a business decided to boost it. We want to put plant-based options everywhere. We want to make them mainstream. In the future, animal products can be grown in a lab. You don't have to kill animals or even hurt them. Animal products can be grown in a lab. Agriculture will be replaced by other means of producing food that are a lot more efficient. You can get all your nutrients in a single bottle. Food can be hacked. You can consume any amount of junk food and still remain healthy. The future of food is exciting. And in the future, all food will be cruelty-free, eco-friendly, tasty and nutritious. Our products are already all that today. We decided we want to do this for good. We don't want to do this just to increase our bank balance. We don't want to do this because we want to be richer. To us, this is sustainable, funded revolution. Thank you very much for your time.
That was 21-year-old entrepreneur Abhay Rangan speaking at the TEDx Brookfield Conference. You've been listening to Animal Voices here on 100.5 FM, Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, unceded Coast Salish territories. Please join us here next Friday, August 31st at noon for more animal-friendly programming. We here at Animal Voices want to connect with you online. Visit our website at animalvoices.org, where you can stream past shows or download them as podcasts. You can also see our show blog there with detailed links and subscribe to us on iTunes. Stay in touch with us on Facebook, facebook.com/Animal Voices Vancouver, and on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. So now in a minute, we'll leave you with a song. This is a song that I co-wrote and performed on violin with my band, The Living.
What? Cat's out of the bag.
That's right. Yeah. It's kind of, it's an epic ballad about the life and death of a dairy cow. If you like what you hear, visit theliving.ca. The song is entitled Requiem for Bessie. Stay tuned for Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith. Thank you for listening to Animal Voices today, and remember to be kind to the animals.
Hear, hear.
Bessie sees the light, the grounds are mama. Are up, relieved. They snuggle, unaware of what's to come. Morning breaks and Bessie's wrenched away by frigid hands, impervious to mama's bellowing distress. and Bessie cleans her up, relieved, relaxed. For now, she's not sure what's to come. Morning breaks, and sure enough, the hands take Bessie's baby. She cries out in grief, but nothing can be done. Bessie, still a kid herself, births baby after baby, and like clockwork, each is torn away in haste. All they want from Bessie's liquid goals, her productivity is bare amount for manufactured taste. Gentle Bessie mourns as they suck her dry.
Inspected by the crowd.